All right, welcome everybody. This is episode 672 of the Divine Intervention podcast. So today we're going to be continuing the discussion on the most important drugs to know for the USMLE exams. Again, you love the way I teach. You're going to love working with me one-on-one or through my review classes. I have a series of classes starting next week on Monday. Test-taking class, biostats class on Tuesday, social sciences, ethics, quality improvement, and hospital medicine class on Wednesday. And then and those first three classes are for step 1, 2, 3 and level 1, 2, 3. And then on Thursday, I have a last minute review for step 2 and step 3 specifically. And then on Friday, I start a 20-hour review that runs into the next week. So if you're interested in any of these classes, they are live classes over Zoom. I'm the one that teaches all of them. Shoot me an email. I can give you some more information. I can click on the link in the description below, or just email me through the website, divineinterventionpodcast.com. And I also help people with ERAS applications, mock interviews, personal statements, and things of that nature. All right, so let's jump into it. First thing I'm going to start off with is, what if they give you a question about a patient and you're told that the patient, recently started a drug, you know, after they had some cardiac complaints, they were admitted for cardiac complaints recently. And then you're told that the person now has this bluish skin discoloration. And the person now endorses that they have a lot of sensitivity when they step out in the sun. When you see something like that, what drug should you be thinking about? Well, I hope you're saying, Divine, this sounds an awful lot like amiodarone. I know many times people think of amiodarone in terms of the PFT, LFT, and TFT issues, and I'm going to talk about those. But one thing that's also really important to know about amiodarone is that it deposits in the skin, and it actually makes your skin more susceptible to ultraviolet radiation, right? So it can actually cause like sunburns. People can become photosensitive. Remember the drugs that cause photosensitivity on the USMLE exams, right? So sulfonamides, amiodarone, and tetracyclines, right? There's a nice mnemonic to remember there. SAT for photo. So S for sulfonamides, A for amiodarone, T for tetracyclines, right? So that's one area they can go with amiodarone. But right, remember amiodarone, it's a drug that binds lipids very well. So basically, wherever you have a lot of lipid-rich tissue, it can cause a lot of problems, right? So it can deposit in the liver, right? The liver contains quite a bit of fat, right? And it can cause a liver toxicity. So it can raise your LFTs. Another thing amiodarone can also do, right, is it can cause pulmonary fibrosis, right? Again, it can deposit in the lungs. You get a lot of inflammation, free radical production, and that can get you in trouble, right? It also causes thyroid dysfunction, right? So like, for example, it can cause inflammation in the thyroid. So you can release preformed thyroid hormone and get hyperthyroidism that way. But remember, look at the name amiodarone, amioda, right? So it has iodine in its name. So one thing that can happen is that supplied iodine, when the body sees all that extra, when the thyroid sees all that extra iodine, it's like, whoa, this is way too much. So your body's like, you know what? I think I don't want to produce a thyroid hormone anymore, at least for a season. That's the Wolff-Chaikoff effect. But also, sometimes in certain people, if you supply them with extra iodine, like you can get from amiodarone, it can actually make them overproduce thyroid hormone. So that can cause hyperthyroidism. That's the yod-Basedow phenomenon, right? So amiodarone can cause both hyper and hypothyroidism. And one of the mechanisms that he uses to cause it, so remember, the hyperthyroidism mechanism is the yod-Basedow phenomenon. The hypothyroidism mechanism is the Wolff-Chaikoff phenomenon. Well, one other way amiodarone causes hypothyroidism is that it can also decrease the conversion of T4 to T3. Remember, T3 is the metabolically active form of thyroid hormone. It's the more reactive form of thyroid hormone. So you should know that for sure for your exams, right? And then also remember, the cornea has lipid, right? So again, amiodarone can bind to those lipids. So you can have a corneal deposits, right? Again, it can cause that blue-green skin discoloration. So remember, before you start a person on amiodarone, it's probably helpful to get PFT. It's like baseline periodic PFTs, LFTs, and TFTs, right? And then what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient is started on a class 1 antiarrhythmic, you know, for some class 1A antiarrhythmic for some kind of arrhythmia, right? And then you're told, prior to initiating pharmacotherapy, which of the following is the most appropriate next step in management? Well, remember, class 1A antiarrhythmics, right? These are drugs like quinidine, right? These are drugs like quinidine, right? I know you may be like, there's no way they test these things on exams. No, they definitely do test them on exams. And the thing is, they're sodium channel blockers, right? So they're going to basically slow down depolarization of your cardiac myocytes, right? So the thing is, if you slow down depolarization, you can certainly get into trouble with prolonging the QT interval, right? So you should get a baseline EKG before you start these drugs, right? Monitor these people's QT interval. And one thing I've noticed that our friends at the MBMEs love doing with these drugs is that they love doing combinations. What in the world do I mean by combinations? Basically, like, you'll be taking this drug and then they will ask you, which of the following is contraindicated, or they can ask you which of the following should be avoided, or they can ask you which of the following should be monitored. When people are on these sodium channel blockers, it's usually a good idea to, again, monitor the QT interval, but also monitor their potassium and magnesium, right? Because remember, hypokalemia and hypomagnesemia can both trigger a prolongation of the QT interval, can cause torsade de pointe, right? These drugs, these class 1 antiarrhythmics, especially the class 1As, they're very big on causing a torsade de pointe, so you want to be careful about those, right? And then I guess a special mention of quinidine, right? Quinidine, remember, it can cause synchronism. It can cause what? Synchronism, right? It can cause like tinnitus, it can cause headaches and things of that nature. I'll certainly know that for exams if I were you. All right, so since we're talking about antiarrhythmics, let's kind of round up some more here. So let's talk about beta blockers, right? Remember, beta blockers are class 2 antiarrhythmics, right? And again, beta blockers, there's many things they're used for. There are many side effects to know. But again, what are the key things you definitely want to know for your exams? Key things you want to know is that, number one, they can precipitate bronchospasm in asthmatics, right? They can precipitate bronchospasm in asthmatics, right? Remember, we treat asthma with beta-2 agonists like albuterol, which is a SABA, a short-acting beta-2 agonist, or salmeterol, formoterol, which are LABAs, long-acting beta-2 agonists, right? So the thing is, these drugs, if you're using beta-2 agonists to treat asthma, if you're taking a beta blocker, that can certainly cause bronchospasm, and that can cause issues, right? So you want to be careful about bronchospasm in asthmatics, giving those people beta blockers, right? And also, another thing you want to know about beta blockers is that they can actually mask the tachycardic warning sign that you get in diabetics, right? So the thing is, when you become hypoglycemic, your tissues become essentially starved for energy, right? So they're going to be more requiring of oxygen. And because they're more requiring of oxygen, your cardiac output is going to rise. One classic response to tissue hypoxia is a rise in cardiac output. So if your cardiac output rises a lot, right, that's tachycardia. But if you're taking a beta blocker, that's going to blunt that effect. Because remember, beta blockers can shut down conduction, you know, down the AV node and things like that. So I'll certainly keep that in mind for exams. I'd certainly keep that in mind for exams if I were you, right? Beta blockers, they blunt that tachycardic response, right? They certainly blunt that tachycardic response. That's something that's very, very, very high yield to know for exams. Very, very high yield to know for exams, right? Now, what's another thing you also want to keep in mind? Again, just be cautious, right? Because I know many people memorize this rule that, if you're taking a beta blocker that is A through M, it's okay. It's not a big deal. That is not necessarily true, guys. That is not necessarily true, right? So you're taking a beta blocker A through M. Yes, don't get me wrong. They have less risk of bronchospasm compared to, there's less risk of bronchospasm with those compared to the standard beta blockers like propranolol that are non-selective. But the risk is certainly not zero. The risk is certainly not zero, right? These drugs can cause significant problems, even if you're taking the ones that are numbered A through M, right? So that's just something you want to keep at the back of your mind as you're studying for your exams, right? The MBMEs, they like to occasionally throw people for a loop. And one classic loop they like to throw people for is, you notice that, this person is taking atenolol, for example, but they still have bronchospasm from it. So just be careful. Just be careful. It's something you certainly want to keep at the back of your mind as you're studying for your exams. All right. Now, what are the close cousins of beta blockers? Well, I guess that takes us to the class 4 antiarrhythmics. Those are the calcium channel blockers, right? Those are the calcium channel blockers. Although, one thing I've noticed about the calcium channel blockers is that the USMLEs, they tend to feast most of their efforts in the dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, right? Remember, there's obviously the non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers like verapamil or diltiazem, right? Those are class 4 antiarrhythmics. You know, those are negative inotropes, and we can use them for things like Prinzmetal angina. There's also verapamil that is used to reduce the number of cluster headaches that people have. But, you know, the dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers is where it's at from a USMLE perspective, right? And the thing is, remember these drugs, these are arteriolar dilators. So because the arteriolar dilators, they're going to basically cause you to send more blood to your systemic capillaries. If you send more blood to your systemic capillaries, that's going to cause you to have an increase in hydrostatic pressure within your systemic capillaries, right? So if you increase those hydrostatic pressures, you're going to have more fluid extravasation. You're going to get peripheral edema, right? So peripheral edema is a big thing that we tend to find with these drugs. Well, how can we treat or prevent that? Well, we can treat that typically by giving an ACE inhibitor, an ARB, because remember the way blood vessels work in the body, right? We have the arterioles, and then those lead to capillaries, and then those lead to venules. Those venules come after capillaries. So if you could dilate those venules, that will bring blood out of those capillaries, out of those systemic capillaries. That will reduce the hydrostatic pressure within those systemic capillaries, and that can reduce that fluid extravasation, right? So ACE inhibitors and ARBs are systemic venule dilators, right? So they reduce hydrostatic pressures within your systemic capillaries. That's pretty high yield to know for exams. Now, another big side effect you want to know with the dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers is that they cause gingival hyperplasia. They cause gingival hyperplasia. And what's the mechanism there? Well, the thing is, again, these drugs, right? These dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, they block L-type calcium channels, right? Please, that's a tidbit you certainly want to make sure you know for your exams, right? They are L-type calcium channel blockers. Remember, there are T-type calcium channel blockers like ethosuximide that we used for the management of absence seizures, right? But these drugs are L-type calcium channel blockers, right? So if you block L-type calcium channels, which we find in fibroblasts, that's going to impair the ability of them to break down collagen, right? The ability of enzymes like matrix metalloproteinases to work. And if matrix metalloproteinases do not work, then you're not going to be able to break down, right, collagen. And that collagen is going to build up. You're going to get a lot of inflammation within your gums. And that's the thing that actually causes the gingival hyperplasia that we find with these dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers. Now, again, going with this combinatorial idea that I talked about with the USMLEs, again, the USMLEs, they like to give you a problem and ask what is contraindicated, right? Or they ask like, oh, which of the following combinations would most increase a person's risk of having this side effect, of having this adverse reaction? Well, you certainly want to keep cyclosporin in mind, right? So taking cyclosporin and taking a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker is not a very smart idea. It's not a very smart idea, right? Because again, cyclosporin is an immunosuppressant. It also does cause gingival hyperplasia. Same thing you can also get with a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker. Now, one thing that I would say that our friends at the MBMEs occasionally test on the exams is differentiating the edema, right? Because the thing is, it's not all edema that is created equal, right? I just said that you literally can get a peripheral edema from dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers. But remember, you can also get peripheral edema from a volume overload, right? But the thing is, people that have peripheral edema from a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, that peripheral edema does not respond very well to diuretics because, again, it's from arteriolar dilation. That's the mechanism behind the edema. It's not from volume overload. Volume overload is not the mechanism behind the peripheral edema in a person that has a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker toxicity. In fact, our friends at the MBMEs, classic thing they love to do is they'll give you a question about a person having peripheral edema and ask about the mechanism behind it, right? So remember, for a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, it's from arteriolar dilation. From a person that, for example, has CHF, right? It's from that person just having poor forward flow. So the heart cannot contract very well. So because it's not contracting well, fluid is basically backing up in the body. Or if you see a person that has like nephrotic syndrome or some kind of protein malnutrition, right? It can be from decreased serum oncotic pressures, right? So they have increased fluid extravasation, right? Guys, make sure you understand these mechanisms. The USMLEs these days are mechanistic exams. The USMLEs these days are not I memorized an association, I matured an Anki deck exams. Just going to keep that in mind. I know sometimes many people online, they'll see a person that matured an Anki deck and got a 270. The thing is, guys, let me tell you this. It's not the maturation of the Anki deck specifically that caused those people to get a 270. The thing that causes people to do really well is that they already have work behaviors and work ethics that are led them to do those things. Chances are if they did probably any other thing, they probably still have succeeded. Those are people that still, in addition, people don't tell their full stories online. Those are people that still, in addition to their maturing and Anki deck, they also have like very deep knowledge of things. They have a very good foundation, very good fund of knowledge. But many people do not think of those things, right? Again, remember, correlation does not mean causation. I feel like people don't apply just basic wisdom and common sense when reading some experiences of people that get these very high scores on exams. I'm telling you this as a person that got a very high score on my exam, and telling you this as a person that has worked with tons of very high scorers on the exams, right? So just remember, maturing an Anki deck, the fact that you do those things that they did in their write-up doesn't mean you're going to do well on your exams. It doesn't, right? There's more nuance and more context that people should consider. And I guess since we're kind of talking about ACE inhibitors and ARBs, I think it'd be helpful to just kind of stream into those, right? Again, I'm trying to kind of string these things together to kind of help you see these connections and correlations as we go, right? But remember, the big things you want to know about ACE inhibitors is that they cause a dry cough, right? From accumulation of bradykinin. Remember, angiotensin converting enzyme, right? It's expressed in the lungs, right? It's expressed in your pulmonary capillaries, right? So the thing is, if you're inhibiting ACE, you're not going to be able, because normally ACE breaks down bradykinin. So if you're not able to break down bradykinin, you're going to express very high levels of bradykinin in the lungs, in the pulmonary system. So it makes sense that a dry cough, right, makes sense, right? It makes sense that a dry cough side effect should make sense, because literally that's like where the enzyme is. The enzyme is like literally in the lungs. Man, I wish people just devoted more time and effort to trying to understand things mechanistically instead of just blindly memorizing things. Like, it makes sense, right? ACE is heavily expressed in the lungs. So it makes sense that, wait, if you're getting a toxicity from buildup of bradykinin, it's going to be in that general area. You're going to have a dry cough. So typically in those people, you're going to go ahead and switch to an ARB, right? An angiotensin II receptor blocker like losartan, for example, right? Now remember, ACE inhibitors can also cause angioedema because of the bradykinin, right? Again, remember, bradykinin increases vascular permeability, right? And ACE inhibitors can also cause you to have hyperkalemia, right? Because if you think about it, if you're inhibiting ACE, you're not converting angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2. You have less angiotensin 2. If you have less angiotensin 2, you're going to have less aldosterone, because one of the jobs of angiotensin 2 is to go to the zona glomerulosa of the adrenal cortex and cause you to release more aldosterone. If you don't release aldosterone, you're going to have low levels of aldosterone. And one of the jobs of aldosterone is to cause you to excrete potassium in your urine. But if you're not doing that, you're going to hold on to that potassium. You're going to get hyperkalemia. You're going to see that actually come into play in something else I'm going to discuss, right? So, And these drugs are also teratogens, right? They literally cause like fetal renal damage. So they can cause oliguria, they can cause oligohydramnios. Because remember, how do babies work? Well, babies, they urinate and then they swallow their urine, right? A lot of what you think is amniotic fluid is actually fetal urine, right? So if, for example, for some reason, the kidneys have been messed up, the fetus is not going to make urine. And if a fetus does not make urine, number one, you're going to have oligohydramnios. That can be an OB-GYN presentation on your exams. But another problem with oligohydramnios is that since the child is not making enough urine, right, they're not swallowing that urine anymore, right? And the thing is, one of the places that swallowed urine goes to is the lungs. It causes the lungs to expand and develop, right? So if you're not making enough urine, you're not swallowing that urine, your lungs are not expanding or developing, right, then that's going to cause pulmonary hypoplasia. That's probably like the most common cause of demise in a child that has Porter sequence. That's pretty high yield to know for your exams, right? Again, I know this is a pharmacology review, but you see all these integrations that we're making. These are things I love to do with my review classes and in my one-on-one tutoring as well, right? So let's continue there, right? So again, if you have this dry cough with an ACE inhibitor, go ahead and switch to an ARB, right? But remember, again, you can get angioedema, you can get hyperkalemia. These drugs are teratogens. Again, they cause fetal renal damage. All right. And remember, ACE inhibitors, they do improve survival in heart failure, right? Okay. And then again, we're talking about these things. Let's string it along to the thiazide diuretic, right? So remember, thiazides, right? Thiazides cause a lot of problems, right? They cause a lot of problems. They are one of the first line medications for the management of essential hypertension, right? So remember, we can use thiazide diuretics, we can use ACE inhibitors or ARBs, or we can use dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers. I remember with the mnemonic CAT, right, the C4 calcium channel blockers, again, those L-type dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, the A4 ACE inhibitors or ARBs, the T4 thiazide diuretics, right? Those are first-line drugs for the management of essential hypertension, right? Now, remember your thiazide diuretics, right? So they do cause hyponatremia. Remember your thiazides, they work at the level of the distal convoluted tubule. They prevent you from reabsorbing sodium and chloride, right? So the thing is, you're literally dumping ions in the urine. But these drugs, you're dumping those ions in the urine, you're dumping sodium ions, you're dumping chloride ions in the urine, but you're not messing up that medullary concentrating gradient. It's still intact. It's still there. Remember, your medullary concentrating gradient is a gradient that exists in the medulla of your renal system that helps you reabsorb water, from your urine. Now, the thing is, if you're taking let me back up a little bit. So that's the first point. The second point is that medullary concentrating gradient is created by ions. Where do those ions come from? Those ions largely come from the loop of Henle. Not from the distal convoluted tubule. So, if you take a thiazide diuretic, you're dumping sodium ions in your urine. You're literally losing sodium. You're literally losing chloride. But are you messing up that medullary concentrating gradient that can help you reabsorb water? No. So you're losing sodium in your urine, but your medullary concentrating gradient that helps you reabsorb water is still intact. Because it's still intact, thiazide diuretics have a very high risk of hyponatremia compared to many of the other diuretics because they're making you lose electrolytes, they're making you lose ions in your urine, but your medullary concentrating gradient is still intact because they don't touch the loop of Henle. This is very different from a loop diuretic. A loop diuretic can cause hyponatremia, but the risk is much lower than a thiazide diuretic because, again, a loop diuretic, look at the name, loop diuretic, literally works at the level of the loop of Henle. So you're dumping ions in your urine, that's true, but you're also messing up one of the major sources of that medullary concentrating gradient. So you're not going to just be dumping ions and still reabsorbing tons of water from your urine. No, you're going to be dumping ions and you're going to be also dumping a ton of water into your urine, right? This is part of why loop diuretics are the most powerful diuretics. Right? But they have less risk of hyponatremia because you're losing sodium, you're losing chloride, you're losing potassium. Because remember, right, loop diuretics, they block that sodium potassium 2 chloride transporter that we find at the level of the loop of Henle. But the medullary concentrating gradient is being destroyed. So you're also losing tons of water in your urine. That's why, number one, they're the most powerful diuretics. But number two, that's also part of why they don't have as much risk of hyponatremia as we find with other diuretics. They don't have that as much risk of hyponatremia, right? So that's pretty high yield to know for your exams, right? Because again, you're losing sodium and water proportionately. So let's go back to thiazides. I'll just discuss them side by side with loops. But thiazides, remember, they also cause hyperglycemia, right? So if you remember the way insulin is produced, right? So remember basically like glucose enters through GLUT2 transporters into the pancreatic beta cells, right? And then that glucose is converted to ATP, you know, glycolysis and the like. And then that ATP blocks the potassium channel, right? And then when you block that potassium channel in the pancreatic beta islet cells, right, it's going to cause the pancreatic beta islet cell to depolarize. And then calcium is going to rush in and you're going to release insulin, right? So that potassium channel has to be blocked for that cell to be depolarized, for calcium ions to rush in, for it to release insulin. Well, one thing that can happen there, unfortunately, is that thiazide diuretics, they open up potassium channels. They do open up potassium channels. So when you open up those potassium channels, you are preventing the beta cell from depolarizing. And if the beta cell does not depolarize, you will not release insulin. If you don't release insulin, then you're going to have hypoinsulinemia. Thiazide diuretics, they cause hypoinsulinemia. So that's why they're kind of a problem sometimes in diabetics, because they can actually worsen your insulin resistance. That's number one. Number two, they cause hyperglycemia, right? Because again, if you make less insulin, you're going to be less able to drive glucose into your cells. So you're going to have hyperglycemia. Another thing you can also get with that is that you can also get hyperlipidemia, right? Because again, remember, one of the jobs of insulin is to help you take lipids and put them into your fat cells, right? So if you have hypoinsulinemia, that can cause problems, right? Now, some other issues you can get with thiazides, remember, they can cause hyperuricemia, right? Because they compete for the same transporters that you're using your kidneys to excrete uric acid. So you're going to have less uric acid excretion, right? So taking the thiazide diuretic, if you have a history of gout, may not be the smartest idea in the world, right? But also, they can also cause hypercalcemia. The thing is, the hypercalcemia mechanism is kind of a little bit complicated, but basically, what I'll just say is this, right? So thiazides, they reduce the intracellular amount of calcium that we find in a distal convoluted tubule cell. They reduce that intracellular calcium. By reducing intracellular calcium, they basically increase the incentive for your distal convoluted tubule cells to reabsorb more calcium, right? So they reduce the amount of calcium that's in your urine. That's why they're very good in people that have a history of kidney stones, right? Because they reduce how much calcium is in your urine. And they're also good in osteoporosis, right? So let's say, for example, you have hypertension and osteoporosis. Thiazide diuretics are good because they basically cause you to reabsorb more calcium from your urine. Probably in a future podcast, I will discuss that mechanism in detail. Or I'm pretty sure I've discussed that actually in detail in other podcasts in the past, right? So again, very good adjunct for high blood pressure management people that have like osteoporosis, right? Or people that have recurring calcium kidney stones, right? And then loop diuretics, as I mentioned, right? So loop diuretics, as I mentioned, they have less risk of hyponatremia compared to thiazide diuretics, right? But they can certainly cause hyperuricemia because, again, they compete for those same transporters, again, that they help you excrete uric acid, right? And then remember, loop diuretics are ototoxic. Loop diuretics are ototoxic, right? They can damage cranial nerve number 8. So they are ototoxic, right? So again, our friends at the MBME is bringing in those combinatorials again. Our friends at the MBME is like you to know that, again, you don't want to combine loop diuretics with drugs that can also that are also ototoxic, because you're basically getting like a combinatorial effect, right? So how exactly does this work? How exactly does this work? Well, the thing is aminoglycosides, probably the biggest classic one they love to test on exams, right? You don't want to be taking a loop diuretic and aminoglycoside at the same time. Aminoglycosides are very, very ototoxic. What are the other ototoxic drugs you need to know for your exams? Well, don't forget cisplatin. Your platinum agents are also ototoxic, right? And then also don't forget vancomycin is also ototoxic, right? So remember, vancomycin is ototoxic, aminoglycosides are ototoxic, loop diuretics are also ototoxic, cisplatin, your platinum analogs are ototoxic. Another thing that's also pretty high to know is there's this drug, there's this agent, styrene, right? So they can talk about a person that makes polystyrene products. Boy, I'm sure that's something you've not heard in any resource, but actually very high to know for exams, right? So styrene is also can cause a hearing issues, right? So just something I want to keep in mind. So let's say a person works in a polystyrene manufacturing a facility or something along those lines. All right, so what are some other things you want to know about loop diuretics? Well, remember, they cause hypokalemia with a metabolic alkalosis. Same thing with thiazides, right? And how do they do that? Again, remember, these drugs are diuretics. So because they are diuretics, they make your volume depleted. When your volume depleted, you're going to polyperfuse your juxtaglomerular cells, your afferent arteriole, your juxtaglomerular cells. So that's going to cause you to release release renin. And then renin is going to convert angiotensinogen to angiotensin 1. And then angiotensin 1 goes to the lungs, pulmonary capillaries, right? Expresses ACE, is going to make angiotensin 2. And then angiotensin 2 is going to go to the zona glomerulosa of the adrenal cortex and cause you to produce aldosterone. Aldosterone causes you to excrete potassium and hydrogen ions in your urine. So if you excrete potassium, you develop hypokalemia. If you excrete hydrogen ions, you're going to develop a metabolic alkalosis, right? You're going to develop metabolic alkalosis, right? So many diuretics have that combination. Your thiazides, your loops, they both cause a hypokalemia or a metabolic alkalosis. Again, if you notice, I'm trying to kind of bridge many things together, and again, also try to keep this podcast short. Again, finding those fine lines is kind of difficult, but I also don't want to go into things that are fluff and low yield. So I want to keep this podcast as concentrated and as high yield as possible. I want it to be something where you take a 30-minute dose and it just hits your brain hard, right? Hits your brain hard for your exams, right? So again, remember, loop diuretics, again, hypokalemia, metabolic alkalosis, right? And again, the ototoxicity is usually reversible. If you stop the loop diuretic, typically the ototoxicity basically kind of goes away. Now, one weird thing our friends at the MBM is, they can test this with any diuretic, especially diuretics that cause hypokalemia, but they love this, especially with loops, right? Because who are the people that take loops? These are people that have heart failure, right? These are people that have heart failure, right? Because remember, loop diuretics, they're like the water pill that heart failure patients take. But one other thing that's pretty high yield to know for exam purposes is that right? This hypokalemia can be an issue, right? Especially in people that have that are taking digoxin. And hey, who are the people that take digoxin? These are people that have heart failure as well. Digoxin is a positive inotrope, right? So the thing is, remember, digoxin works by inhibiting the sodium potassium ATPase pump. I'll probably talk about it in the next part of this series, right? But it inhibits the sodium potassium ATPase pump. Now, the thing is, for digoxin to bind, you need to have open sites, and those open sites are potassium binding sites on the sodium potassium ATPase pump. So if you have hypokalemia, you have more open sites on the sodium potassium ATPase pump for digoxin to bind. And if digoxin binds, that's going to be a problem, right? You're going to have more binding of digoxin, more accumulation of digoxin. So you're going to have a higher risk of digoxin toxicity, And then I guess to kind of round up these diuretics, right? Don't forget your spironolactone, right? Spironolactone is an aldosterone receptor blocker, right? So basically going to get the opposite of what you're supposed to get with aldosterone. Remember, aldosterone makes you excrete potassium and hydrogen ions in your urine. If you don't do that, right? If you're getting the opposite of that, you won't excrete hydrogen ions, right? So you get a metabolic acidosis and you won't excrete potassium ions. So you're going to get hyperkalemia. Right, so spironolactone can cause hyperkalemia, it can cause metabolic acidosis, right? Cause anti-androgen effects as well, right? Because remember, spironolactone also blocks androgen receptors, right? It's an androgen receptor blocker. It blocks androgen receptors, right? So it can cause gynecomastia, it can cause menstrual irregularities, right? So you see a person that's taking an aldosterone receptor antagonist and they develop menstrual irregularities, it's probably from spironolactone. Remember, we don't get that problem with eplerenone. Eplerenone only blocks aldosterone receptors. It does not have those anti-androgenic properties that we find with spironolactone. And remember, spironolactone does improve survival in heart failure. Now remember, because it can cause hyperkalemia, do not combine it with other drugs that can cause hyperkalemia, like what? Like ACE inhibitors, like ARBs, right? Like potassium sparing diuretics. You don't want to combine those two. You don't want to combine those drugs with an ACE inhibitor and with an aldosterone antagonist like spironolactone, because you can get a dangerous life-threatening hyperkalemia. All right. Now, final drugs I'm going to talk about, because this is kind of coming up on 30 minutes. I really want to keep these things to about 30 minutes as well. Just to kind of manage length, right? But don't forget statins, right? Statins are pretty high yield to know for your exams, right? Remember, they can cause LFT abnormalities, right? They're hepatotoxic, right? And again, they can cause like rhabdomyolysis, right? So you can see like red urine in these people. Remember, if you do urine microscopy, you're not going to find red blood cells, right? Because it's myoglobin you're finding in the person's urine, not hemoglobin, right? So that's pretty high yield to know for purposes of your exams, right? So remember, they can cause myopathy. They can cause rhabdomyolysis because of that coenzyme Q business, right? And again, combinatorials. Guys, do not combine a statin with a fibrate, something like gemfibrozil or fenofibrate or clofibrate. You combine those two, then you're going to get in hot water with myopathy, right? So just be careful about those, right? So remember, your statins, right? They're myotoxic and they're hepatotoxic. They're myotoxic and they're hepatotoxic. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and stop here. Again, if you like the way I teach, you're going to love my classes. You're going to love working with me one-on-one for tutoring. You're going to love working with me for your ERAS applications. But I also, especially if you have like red flags on your applications, I also work with people that don't have red flags. That's fine, obviously, right? But if you're a person that has failed a USMLE exam, I have a very, very good track record, especially with people that have failed. There are many people I've worked with that have failed their USMLEs multiple times and they've passed on the next try, right, after working with me. And then also I have another website called divineinterventionlifelessons.com. Many of you know I'm a Christ follower. Every week I post like one or two podcasts where, from a biblical perspective, I address a life lesson. So check that out, divineinterventionlifelessons.com. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast. So thank you for listening to me today. I will see you in part 4 of 6, right? That's going to be episode 673. Have a wonderful day. God bless you and bye for now. Thank you.